Coming to you direct from the heart of New York City, all the way to wherever you are, you're listening to the VIP Jaswal Report. Ladies and gentlemen, the competitive nature of college admissions continues to mount, and students and parents wonder, is taking the redesigned SAT over the ACT currently worth the risk? So to help us with this dilemma, I bring to you Mr. Eric Greenberg, president of the leading test preparation and college advising firm, the Greenberg Educational Group, who, along with his team of expert advisors, they've been helping families through this evolving test preparation process. We're going to be talking about how colleges really view the SAT versus the ACT, the radical new changes to the SAT, the issues involved in taking the redesigned SAT test this year over the ACT, and who should do which test, and how to study for the test, and so much more. So let's get to it. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you, Vip. Nice to be with you again.
Well, so tell me, what does the Greenberg Educational Group do?
We specialize in three areas, one of which is standardized test preparation, another is advising for a college and graduate school, and then we do a lot of academic tutoring as well. We work with kids not only throughout the United States, but also internationally as well, and we do a lot of work via Skype and in person.
So what are the most common problems, you know, when parents have that you resolve? What's the service you provide?
Well, the most significant question that's coming up among parents and families that we see now is they're very confused as to how to deal with a new version of the SAT.
Right.
And as you know, the new version of the SAT is coming out this coming March, so a lot of people are very, very interested in finding out how they can learn about the test and if they can competitively take it as opposed to taking the ACT.
Okay, and hopefully, you know, we'll get into this in more detail. But obviously, when parents bring their kids, where do you find that your students or your clients fail the most? In which area?
That's a great question. I think the area is juggling the complexity of being a high school student today. Many students come in saying that they have a large work schedule, they have a lot of athletics, they have a lot of art, they have a lot of music, they have to study for the SATs or the ACTs, and they find it difficult to prioritize and figure out where to put the attention. So what we focus in on is on the college preparation side and on the test prep side, how to get the kids to really focus and really maximize their time because there's so many competing interests.
Do you believe that anyone can do well in these test preparation?
I think virtually everybody can improve, and I think the reason why is because if one has his or her mind set to it and somebody's dedicated to it, the world is an oyster, as they say, and I think there are many, many possibilities to improve and, quite frankly, many different ways to improve on this testing.
So the way the tests are prepared, like, and we're going to talk about the SAT and ACT, but both of them, they allow for everyone of different abilities?
Yes, yes. And the reality is that many colleges in the United States do require SAT or ACT, but there are a significant number that don't. But among the colleges that do require SAT or ACT, the vast, vast majority of them will take either test. And many people think colleges have a bias towards one or the other, but the colleges typically will accept either one.
You said some colleges don't require SAT and ACT.
Right.
Are those equally good colleges?
Well, there's a general trend for better colleges to be more likely to require SAT or ACT. With that being said, a lot of competitive colleges have recently dropped the requirement for standardized testing as a mechanism, number one, to get more applications, and number two, philosophically, they don't feel that the testing is really a great indicator of college success.
So you're saying, you know, to get more applications. So if they need more applications, I mean, between you and me and the audience, does that mean they're actually not that good?
Not at all. Not at all. The reality is colleges compete in three substantial ways, one of which is how they can get the greatest number of applications. Another one is how they can take as few people as possible. And number three, how they can get the greatest number of people to say yes among those they offer admission to. So a lot of it is a numbers game, quite frankly. So getting a lot of applications is in many cases thought of as being consistent with a good reputation.
The top-tier universities, like say, let's say the top 40% of universities, they still require standardized testing.
Many of them do, and I would say that there's a slight tendency for the top universities to be doing away with some of the SAT and ACT requirements. With that being said, the vast majority of top schools do require SAT or ACT.
So if, you know, I want to get this SAT and ACT thing out of the way with the requirement of it. Those who don't require it, those universities that don't require it, what are they replacing that requirement with?
It's not so much that they're replacing the requirement. It's just that they're looking at things in different ways. For example, they'll typically put more weight on academic grades. They'll put more weight on degree of difficulty of courses, and they will likely put more emphasis on extracurricular community service and summer activities. So they're basically spreading the pie around in a different way, but they're not really replacing it directly with anything.
So students might think that, oh, I might get away with standardized testing, but that doesn't mean that it gets easier. They just have to up their grades in other areas.
Absolutely, and I would argue that it doesn't get easier. It just gets different.
Right.
And that's the new reality of college admissions. The issue is that colleges are looking at many more different things now than they were years ago, so the whole landscape is a lot different from decades ago.
You know, for some students who might be listening today, give us an idea. Is the competitive nature of the whole college application process, is it increasing now with global students coming in, academic levels getting higher?
It is, and there's three main reasons why college admissions at competitive colleges are more difficult now than ever. One of the reasons is that the economy has been better in the past 10, 20 years than it has been over many times in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, you have a lot more international students applying. And the third issue, which is very, very important, which I think a lot of the students out there listening know about and would love to learn more about, is the Common Application, which is basically a centralized mechanism for applying to college, which makes it much easier and much more efficient in many ways.
Now, you're of the firm belief that colleges don't discriminate against SAT and ACT?
The vast majority of schools do not have a preference. Mm-hmm. If you ask admissions at many of the schools in the country, what they would say is we prefer whichever one you're going to do better on, because both tests are taken by over 1.5 million people per year. Mm-hmm. Both tests have been around for a long time, so the college is more interested in the higher score as opposed to which test specifically. And that's an interesting point that you bring up, because for many, many years, the SAT was given primarily East Coast and West Coast, and the ACT, the Midwest and the South. But the paradigm's changing. And all over the country, you have many, many people in all geographic areas taking either the SAT or the ACT, and sometimes, quite frankly, both.
But the universities, I mean, the schools, they will tell you which one they want, or they just say, we want SAT or ACT?
What they will say is, given that most schools will take either of them, they will just publicly say, listen, either one is fine, send us what you want. Most schools do not really care which one, so it's really up to the student to decide, and it's a very, very hard choice for students and parents to make.
Okay. Now, you said recently that in March, the whole SAT is changing. Why the change? I mean, was something wrong with it before?
I don't think it was so much that there was something wrong with it. It's just that the SAT is changing to look a lot more like the ACT. And historically, just to talk for a moment about the economics of it, the ACT in recent years has been gaining a lot of ground in terms of market share. Mm. A lot more people have been taking the ACT. And in fact, a couple of years ago, more people took the ACT than take the SAT. So as a way to kind of counteract that gradual movement towards the ACT, the SAT people felt in many ways that maybe it was time for a change, and they kind of looked introspectively and felt that kind of a new type of test might be helpful. And the March test, the inaugural, you know, SAT this March, is going to resemble the ACT a lot more than a lot of people might think.
If it's going to resemble the ACT, me as a parent, I would say we might as well go and do the ACT.
Perhaps, Perhaps. I mean, there are certain components of the SAT that are better for some students, and certain parts of the ACT that are better for others. I don't think that I don't have any personal bias, nor does my team, as to which one a student takes. It's our goal to have the student take the one where he or she will do better.
So what are the most significant changes in the SAT now that you're aware of?
Sure. The big picture items are, number one, a lot of the very kind of subtle, annoying vocabulary that was on the old format of the SAT is no longer there, so you don't have to sit down and memorize on Quizlet or index cards of thousands of words, so that's gone away. Another issue which is very, very important is the essay on the SAT has become optional. And the other very, very big difference is that there's no longer a penalty for guessing. So leaving a question blank on the SAT under the new format and getting it wrong is equivalent.
You said the essay is optional.
The essay is now optional on the SAT.
So the student doesn't have to do it.
That's true to some extent, although some colleges will likely be requiring that a student takes it. It's our recommendation that a student take it regardless, because it's very, very important for college admissions people to see a writing sample, and this is often the only case where they will see a timed writing
sample. I'm a little confused. The essay on the application form or the essay in the SAT?
Right. I'm talking about the essay on the SAT because this is really the only version of a timed writing sample they will see. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when they're writing applications, they can sit and ponder and take as long as they want, whereas on the SAT essay, it's timed. So it really replicates, in many cases, what, say, a midterm or a final might look like in college.
It's just strange colleges would prefer you to do the essay on the ACT, on the SAT, because in their own application form on colleges, they have an essay.
They do, but I think the big picture item there is I think there's value in a college seeing writing that a student has done under time conditions versus under non-time conditions. And a typical student in college will be writing some papers out of class and then some papers in class. So the college seeing how a student writes under that pressure or without that pressure I think is very valuable on both sides.
Now, in your particular profession, you're in touch, I guess, with both sides, one being the student and the parent, but you're also in communication with the colleges.
Correct.
Obviously, colleges are aware of the new SAT. Have you had any feedback or concerns from them?
Well, it's not so much a concern because, you know, it hasn't been administered yet, so it's more, I guess, a theory, but a lot of people are interested in knowing what the difficulty level of the test will be. And with any major revision of a test, by definition, there are not too many sample problems out there. There's not all that much to practice on. So any new format of a test, whether it's a revision to the SAT or to the ACT or any of the other standardized tests, will make some people anxious because they won't know exactly what to expect. And as we had talked about before, the change to this SAT is really radical. You know, just in terms, for example, in the reading comprehension component part of the new SAT, a lot of the reading passages are really testing whether somebody understands the evidence that's put forth. So these are not just random passages where they're going to generically ask about inference or what does a certain line mean. Rather, they really, really want to see how we can analyze it, albeit in a multiple choice format. And most of the new SAT is multiple choice. There's some math problems that are not, and of course the essay isn't, but the majority of the SAT of the new format is multiple choice.
I'm really interested in talking about how students can maximize their performance, right, based on their strengths, now that they have these two options, which I guess are held relatively equally by the colleges. I guess if you had to categorize students in two categories, one would say, like, be strong in the arts and one in strong in science.
Yeah, and you know, what I would say is, you know, many students would benefit tremendously by taking a sample practice test of the SAT and a sample practice test of the ACT,
right,
because that would be a great way of helping to determine. But your point is very well taken that there are, in many ways, personality differences between the tests. For example, the ACT is a bit more math and science oriented.
Right.
The SAT is a little bit more slanted towards humanities and the verbal side of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody's coming in loving science, loving math, they're probably slightly more inclined to the ACT, and if they love the written word and the reading and the vocab and the literature and the writing, they're probably a little bit more inclined towards the SAT. So there are certain differences which do help a family and a student determine which test to take. And by the way, you know, the choice is up to the student and up to the family. So there are millions of juniors, you know, out there who are probably still deliberating what to do this spring.
Well, I'm glad you said that they should give each a try on a practice basis, which leads me to technique now. Because
correct.
Obviously ACT, SAT, there is a technique to success, and I'm guessing that's what you sort of enforce in the Greenberg Educational Group, right?
It's not only something that we enforce, but it's something that we've been doing for 25 years. So it's something that we help students maximize their abilities and options.
Okay, so let me break it down. Let's start with the SAT. You said, you know, that students who are stronger in say, English and history might have a chance of doing better at the SAT. What techniques can they do at home or in their school to help them perfect this technique?
That's a great question, and I will break it down into a couple of different components for your listeners, and I know that I'm sure a lot of students are listening and a lot of parents, so you know everyone can be kind of helpful in the process with regard to SAT and ACT scores. Let's first, if we may, Vip, talk about the reading component of the new SAT.
Okay.
And the reading component is really divided up into four chunks. The first chunk is a passage that deals with contemporary literature. Sometimes it's contemporary, sometimes it's classic, sometimes it's a hybrid between them. So it deals with classic contemporary literature, sometimes U.S.-based, sometimes world literature-based, but it spans a lot of different types of reading. So for students who do a lot of reading and a lot of different from a lot of different eras and a lot of different backgrounds, that can be very, very helpful.
How practice is obviously a prerequisite, but what type of reading should they be doing?
Well, the first issue is that within school they should challenge themselves and take as many literature classes as they reasonably can and as many history classes, because then that will naturally expose them to the widest variety. In addition, it's very important for them to read well-known works from different eras, so they get very used to the different language styles, the different ways of writing, and so forth. As an example, if somebody were to pick out something from the 1800s, say Edgar Allan Poe, they were going to read, just for the sake of argument, say The Raven, and then they compare that to a famous 1900s book by John Steinbeck, say The Grapes of Wrath, the writing styles are very, very different. And then in turn, let's take something very current and very modern from the late 1900s and from the 2000s, the Harry Potter series by J.K. Rowling. And by reading these different types of works from different eras, students will naturally, maybe even without knowing it, quite frankly, but naturally get used to the different styles of writing and so forth, and that will get them used to many different types of passages that they might encounter on the SAT.
Here's the challenge I had when I was a kid and I was reading Shakespeare. I never understood what the hell the guy was saying. Yeah. So when they read some of the older authors, there's a different style of English.
Correct.
Now, reading is one thing, but are you understanding what the author is writing? Where can they go to compare what they've understood with what is meant?
That's a very good question, and I guess the first place they should go would be to speak to their English teachers and their history teachers at school, but there's also a lot of information online. For example, a lot of our clients look at the Norton Anthology. It's N-O-R-T-O-N Anthology. It's online.
Right.
And the Norton Anthology breaks it down into many different periods, everything from the Middle Ages to the 20th century. So a lot of our students, in preparation for this type of testing, they will read a little bit of background on 19th century, 20th century, and so forth. They don't necessarily have to go back to the Middle Ages, although they can if they want.
Mm-hmm.
But there are good sources online which not only give background information, but in many ways distill it down to its basic concept. So it's understandable in 2016, even though it might have been written a couple of hundred years ago.
Yeah, because, you know, like I said with Shakespeare, I mean, I would read it, but it didn't mean that I understood it. And that's the key. You need to be able to understand.
Exactly. And in many ways, bouncing these ideas off teachers or other classmates or going online to various sources, what would happen is that becomes a reality check.
Okay.
That's a way for a student to truly know if he or she is understanding the language in the way it was meant. Because after all, when the SAT starts, when the ACT starts, you cannot ask questions at that point. So the idea is to really go in advance, knowing all the different possibilities that might come up, and to maximize one's options.
So one thing that we've got is they should practice. They should take extra literature lessons, extra history lessons, read books from different stages in time. And that's the literature side of it. What about, like, the history side of it?
On the history side of it, you know, they typically have or will have one passage that will be based upon famous United States or world documents or speeches or texts. So, for example, they might go back to the Constitution. They might have famous speeches from people like, say, Mandela or Winston Churchill or Franklin Roosevelt. They will typically have historical documents or speeches, and then what people have to do is they have to interpret the significance. So a very, very good thing to do along those lines is for students to really do two things. I think the first thing is that in a student's history textbook, they often have the documents in those books. So they should look in the books and read as much as they can about these various documents. The other thing they can do, which is very, very helpful, is if a student, for example, Googled famous United States speeches or famous European speeches or famous African speeches, whatever the case may be, they will get a sense of the different styles, the different eras, and so forth. So in much the same way that you want kind of a broad scope of reading to be done in English lit, you want that to be done in history, because in different time periods, people speak differently. The style of writing has, in many ways, become more brief and more succinct today. So it's good to really understand the different spectrum issues of them.
So really, I mean, grab a hold of a few speeches, read the speech, but make sure you're understanding what that famous person was saying.
That's right.
And that is key, because that's what's going to be tested at the test, right?
Correct. I mean, they're not going to look for simply reading comprehension in a typical sense. They're going to be looking for the meaning behind it. So a very, very good thing to do is after a student reads a speech, they could, for example, type into Google, interpretation of so-and-so's speech, and they can read up on that, and then they can really get the background information of how it was received at that time and perhaps what its significance is in a greater context.
Great. Now, the SAT is divided up into how many sections? There's a reading, there's a writing and language, and I believe there are two math sections and one essay?
Yes, and if I may, Vip, if I may just go back briefly to two other types of passages that will test on the reading. They typically will likely test two types of science. One of the passages will be a social science, so they'll give you a passage that will relate to economics, psychology, sociology, and then what they will typically do is give you another science passage, which will relate to something very, very important in scientific history. For example, something maybe by Newton or Einstein or Galileo. And within that, instead of going back to foundational concepts, instead of that, what they could do, or I guess in addition to that, is they could also talk about some current themes.
Mm-hmm.
They could talk about technology issues and how quickly technology is spreading. So it can range really the whole gamut. And a lot of students might not be quote-unquote science people, so they might be wondering while they're listening to this broadcast about what they can do to adequately prepare. And, you know, a couple of things that a student can do, for example, is they can go online, look at Scientific American magazine, they could look at Smithsonian magazine, Nature magazine is another. And also, for example, there's kind of a very popular tech current events type magazine. It's called Wired Magazine. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with it. They can go online, look at that. They can look at National Geographic. So the ways that they can also better the likelihood of familiarity with a lot of topics and styles of writing on these science passages.
Okay, so talk to me about the different sections and how best to prepare within the SAT.
Sure. And the other writing and verbal type section, aside from the essay, is called Writing and Language Test. And the Writing and Language Test is not really writing because it's all multiple choice, but it's essentially testing the student's ability to understand punctuation, grammar, and writing style. So it's all multiple choice, but they usually give you paragraphs and passages, and then you have to answer multiple choice questions, giving your answers as to whether you think the punctuation is good, grammar is good, writing style is good, etc. So it very much is a slightly different format than the reading.
But it's almost like the fundamentals of the English language.
I would say it's the fundamentals of English language without getting very, very technical about it. They're not asking for justification as to why the answer is what it is, but they really want people to recognize certain things, certain patterns, for example.
Okay. Now, there are two types of math sections, right?
Correct. And the two types of math sections are divided up in the following ways. One is without a calculator. The other one is with a calculator. And that differs a lot from the current format. When I say the current format, you know, some students will be taking the current format of the SAT until February based upon the blizzard that we recently had on the East Coast. But with the new format, which debuts in March, it will be different to the extent that you cannot use a calculator on all of it, but only on some of it.
How best to prepare for each?
Great question. I think the main difference between the new SAT math versus the old SAT math is that the math focus on the new SAT is much more practical in what it tests. For example, it gives a lot more graphs. It asks, in many cases, for conversions, perhaps from feet to inches or centimeters to meters. It might ask questions about currency conversions from one type of currency to another. It deals with topics involving business, profit, loss, and sales, and so forth. It's not that you have to have background knowledge in business or currency conversions, et cetera, but the problems are meant to be related to real life as opposed to abstract problems which are just going after the math. So the idea is it brings in examples that are more broad-based than the math only.
So how should we teach our children to be doing these sort of problems? Should they be doing it in their head? Like if I go to a restaurant and I'm going to give a 20% tip, should I be giving it to my son and saying, calculate that?
Well, you should be giving it to him. Hopefully he'll pay also. But if he doesn't, you know, that's exactly what parents should be doing. Parents should be saying to a student, if, for example, it's a 15% tip versus a 20% tip versus a 5% tip, what do each of those numbers mean? It's those practical real-life examples that matter. So if, for example, somebody is running a half mile and a parent says, well, approximately how many feet is that? It's important to understand how that conversion is made. So the SAT is becoming, in many ways, a bit wordier on the math side because they have to ask these questions. But at the same time, the math is a little bit more practical. That doesn't mean that traditional math is not on there. They do have a lot with algebra. They do have quite a bit with functions and trigonometry and quite a bit less geometry on the new format than on the old format.
And the one where they can use a calculator?
Yes.
How can they practice for that?
Well, the difference there would be that it's not necessarily that the problems are more difficult, it's that the answers might not be as nice in numbers, so they might not end up being numbers that are as easy to compute. The problems that are without a calculator are basically testing kind of broad-based computation, whereas with the calculator, in many cases, you can expect answers where the numbers might be a little bit harder to compute mentally. So it's not that the types of problems are dramatically different. It's that what they require in terms of computation is different. That's why in some they allow the calculator, and on the other, they don't want students to take time using a calculator, so they don't allow the calculator to be used.
Tell me a little bit about the last component for the SAT.
Sure. The last component is the essay component, which, as we said before, is completely optional. And it's a very different format from the old form of the SAT. Hmm. Essentially, what they do is they give a written piece that essentially is like an op-ed. It's basically an opinion piece that somebody is going to write. For example, they might argue why sports is important. They might argue why art is important. They might argue why reading is important. And then it's up to the writer, the student, to critique and give an analysis of how well written that argument was. So instead of a student just saying, well, this is my opinion on the topic, what they're doing is they're being asked really in many ways to write about what the person has written about. So in many ways, it's almost like giving a movie review of something, but, you know, in written form, and it's basically giving a critique of how well an argument has been made.
Now, with this new SAT, my concern is if my son has to practice the new SAT, this is new, so where does he go to practice?
Well, there are a lot of resources, and again, as I mentioned before, you know, our company and myself, we don't have a bias for one test or the other, but if a student, for example, wanted to practice, there are a lot of books commercially available. Princeton Review, Kaplan are some examples. And also on the College Board website, they have links to Khan Academy. And Khan Academy provides free tools and free videos and other
No, I'm talking about the practice to questions, the actual exam.
Sure, sure. Well, that would be found in the same way. For example, if somebody goes on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com and you know, you can buy books written by Princeton Review, by Kaplan, et cetera, which would have sample practice tests. So the practice tests are available, and if somebody wants to look at a sample test, they could go on the College Board website as well. And in addition to that, on the College Board website, they have access to these Khan videos and Khan questions. So there are many, many questions on which a student can practice.
Now, the ACT, I mean, I just want to ask you the same questions again. The ACT, like you said, was, you know, for those who might enjoy math and science a little more, or that's their stronger inclination. Is the format very different from the SAT?
The format of the ACT and the new SAT are a lot similar than the comparison in the past. Mm-hmm. The ACT has changed very little in recent years, and the current format of the ACT has four different sections. The first section is all multiple choice. It's grammar. In many ways, it's very similar to the writing and language test that I talked before on the SAT. There's another section on mathematics, which is all multiple choice. You can use a calculator for the whole section, and it tests really every math level up until calculus, so everything really through pre-calculus, including trigonometry. Then there's another section on reading comp, and then one of the biggest differentiating factors between the tests is that the ACT has a science section. And there's a separate science section which deals with examples that relate to biochemistry, physics, and other types of science. Mm-hmm. And much of it is really data interpretation. So they talk about something in science, and then you have to interpret the data. So one of the reasons why the ACT is a little bit more geared towards people who are more comfortable with math and science is because of the science section. It's one of the differentiating factors.
How many times can you retake each test?
Students can take the test a lot of times. However, at a certain point, sometimes it's good to stop taking the test and focus more perhaps on academic grades, college applications, extracurricular community service. It's our philosophy that a student should typically not take it more than, say, two or three times. Once a student score after having prepared for the test, once a student score gets flat, meaning their rate of increase gets very, very slow or stays about the same, then you probably are close to your peak performance and it might be time to focus on other things. Because most colleges look at a lot of different factors, one of which for many colleges is the SAT or ACT, but you don't want to focus exclusively on the standardized testing and not focus on the other aspects of admissions.
I was thinking, wouldn't it be best to take it three times? And this was my strategy, so tell me why I'm wrong. If it was me, I would take one SAT and I would take one ACT. Now, out of those two, whichever one I did better, I would take that one again and see if I scored better. So that's three. Does that make sense or not?
It might make sense for certain students. Both tests are very well written and both tests are very, very studyable, so to speak. You know, you can prepare and typically gain on both tests. So again, we don't have a preference for one or the other. We think both are, you know, equally good and equally valid. Mm. The reason why we wouldn't typically subscribe to what you mentioned is that it does take a significant amount of time to prepare for each of the tests. So by taking one real test and taking the real test of the other company and then taking another one, maybe, just maybe, all of that effort would have been better being put into one test. So that's why we think for a student taking a practice test at the beginning or at least going online and looking at sample questions, they will typically, if they're going to spend a fixed amount of time on test preparation anyway, they might very well be better off just focusing on one test in which they feel stronger and feel more comfortable.
Now, let's say you take a test and you get a grade and you get a percentile, but you think you can do better.
Mm-hmm.
What should you be doing in between the next test that would make sure that you do better?
Well, a couple of things. You know, what a lot of students benefit by doing is a lot of students will look online after they get the test back, whether it's the SAT or ACT,
mm-hmm.
and they will get a sense in terms of what areas they were stronger in and what areas they were weaker in. So the idea is if somebody has a limited amount of time between testing and whether they're going to be tutored by somebody like us or whether they're going to prepare on their own, the idea really in between tests is to primarily focus on the weaker areas. What happens is some people might find that geometry is harder, some people might find the reading comp is harder, but after having taken a first test, by looking at the score report that comes out, you can often then use that to focus on areas where the most improvement can be had.
Hmm. Now let's get to the nitty-gritty of it. I mean, nothing beats hard work, right?
And it's our philosophy, you know, and you know what we tell our students is to always do a little bit more. So hard work is never a bad thing, and a little more cannot hurt.
But really, how far in advance should you start studying for the test?
It depends on the student, but a lot of students will spend between 3 months and a year preparing for the SAT or the ACT.
Wow.
I know that's not an option for a lot of people, especially if they decide last minute to take it. But typically, we would recommend between 3 months and 12 months, depending upon the diagnostic testing that they do, and also, quite frankly, depending upon how much other work they have and other commitments that they might have.
You know, I mean, the other commitment, it's a part of life. So ideally, I mean, at least how many hours?
I would say it would be terrific for a student to be able to commit 3 or 4 hours a week to the SAT or ACT prep process. I think if they did that over, say, for the sake of argument, 5 or 6 months,
mm-hmm.
And spent 3, 4 hours a week, that should substantially impact the score.
Now, at the Greenberg Educational Group, you must have students who scored brilliantly, yeah?
We have students who have scored extremely well. The bottom line is that most of our students have improved the scores dramatically.
Okay.
Not everybody is aiming for an elite school, and we understand that, we respect that, we appreciate that.
Right.
And it's our philosophy to maximize the options regardless of what level a student is at.
Okay, well, mediocrity is highly overrated. But for those kids who did brilliantly, how many hours were they putting in?
I would say it would be stepped up quite a bit from the 3 hours that I mentioned. I think the kids who really tend to peak their SAT are spending on average about 1 hour per day doing it. So 5, 6, 7 hours a week would be consistent with the effort that students who did really well put in.
And this is how far out?
I would say typically for the students who do best on the test, it would typically be more in the 6 to 12-month preparation time range. Mm-hmm. You know, and most students are taking the SAT or the ACT for the first time towards the end of the junior year. So for a lot of these students, they might be starting at the beginning of the junior year or a couple of months into the junior year.
Now, do the colleges know how many times you've taken the test?
The answer is sometimes. Mm. Most colleges will allow a student to submit whichever test they want, but some colleges do require that all scores are sent. But for most students, they would have the option. So if a student, for example, took it three times and their best test occurred on the second time, for most colleges, they could simply report the second test and not need to mention the other.
How can parents work with the kids on this one? Because some parents provide a tutor, some parents provide, they just leave it to the school and the child. But obviously some parents, you know, want their kids to do as well as possible, and they'll do anything they can. But if they're limited in terms of their economic resources, what can they do?
I think it's not about economic resources as much as it's about doing some of the things we talked about. For example, if a parent sits down with his or her child and reads some of the passages we talked about, for example, goes on to Norton Anthology or does some school reading with a student or looks at some of the documents or does some of the things we talked about with regard to figuring out the tip in a restaurant or figuring out, you know, basic percentages. I think that if a parent is involved in a lot of these skill components of the testing, I think that will go a very, very far way. Mm-hmm. So we believe that students of all socioeconomic backgrounds can benefit by preparation. And in many ways, preparation is key, whether that preparation is done in school or whether the preparation is done through tutoring or online or whatever the case may be. We feel preparation can be enormously helpful for all people in the process.
Even something as simple as, say, reading a Sunday newspaper and discussing current events together and seeing how they form their opinions and what their logic is?
Absolutely. And even, you know, take somebody, for example, who's interested in sports, right? Mm. If they read articles online on ESPN and read about certain articles about why a certain team should or should not have signed a certain athlete, anything that they read that represents different styles, whether it's People magazine, whether it's ESPN, whether it's a classic book, all of those can be helpful because all together they aggregate or combine into a very, very important skill set.
So something as simple as, say, the Super Bowl coming soon. So I should be discussing with my son which teams have the greater chances and why and whose technique is better and which players are more suited.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for example, you know, Cam Newton for the Panthers and and Manning, you know, Peyton Manning for Denver.
Yep.
During the course of the game, you know, it'd be interesting for a student to kind of estimate the percentage passes completed by each of them. So that could be wound into normal conversation without coming across as a math class.
Oh, excellent. At the Greenberg Educational Group, I mean, what are the most common strategies that you guys have provided to your clients, i.e. the families, that have actually caused a significant improvement?
Three strategies I can think of that, you know, have been kind of tested and have worked very, very well. I think the first one is that regardless of what test it is or regardless of whether it's the application process or academic work, I think starting early in the process is key. And we like to say start early, start smart, because it's sometimes difficult when somebody has a lot of different other obligations to focus on one thing and one thing only, so starting early is key. Another thing is students need to allocate enough preparation time. And what I'm talking about is on a weekly basis. The student needs to know in advance, should they be expected to do 2 hours a week for SAT or ACT? Should they expect it to be doing 3 hours a week? All of that has to be built into the equation because high school gets busier as each year goes on. And the third thing that we feel is essential, which in many ways goes with what you and I talked about this afternoon, which in many ways is relevant to students in the U.S. and internationally as well, that the preparation for this type of testing, the preparation for college, the preparation for high school, for grad school, whatever the case may be, is a combination of what goes on in the classroom, but also what goes on outside of the classroom as well. So the combination of what the students bring to the table, so to speak, and the way in which parents interact with the students can be a very, very important key to success.
What do you find? I mean, obviously, you must be meeting with the students as well and getting to know what their life looks like on any given day. What's the biggest stumbling block for students to succeed? Is it their time management, lack of focus, discipline, carelessness? What is it?
I would say the difficulty in managing all of the different aspects of academic, community service, test prep, summer jobs, and you know, other internships and so forth. There's such an expectation on students who are 16, 17, 18, and 19 to do so many different things that in many ways it's sometimes impossible. So sometimes students have to decide to give something up. For example, they might have to give up an extracurricular activity in order to devote the proper time to the SAT or the ACT. So it's very, very important for parents to sit down with their sons and daughters and really figure out how everything can be managed without anything becoming particularly overwhelming.
If the scores are not satisfactory, is all hope lost?
I don't think so at all. If the scores are not satisfactory, number one, a student could take it again, as you and I talked about before. But very, very importantly, if you look at the way college admissions works, for private colleges in the U.S., they typically look at three factors. They typically look at standardized testing, they look at somebody's academic transcript, and then they look at subjective factors, which include extracurricular, community service, college application essays, summers, and so forth. So they look at many different things. Public colleges in the U.S. tend to be a bit more focused on standardized testing and academic grades. But in terms of what your question was, there typically are so many different pieces to what a college looks for in admissions that I would never say all hope is lost. I think the idea is be optimistic, but also be dedicated at the same time.
Well, then up your game in other areas, right?
Correct. And it's a balancing act. You know, the best offensive player in basketball is not necessarily the best on defense.
Right.
And that has to be built into the equation.
Well, Eric, I mean, we've almost come to the end of the show. How can people get in touch with you?
Well, people could find us on our website. It's www.greenberg, that's G-R-E-E-N-B-E-R-G, educationalgroup.com.
And do you guys have a number?
Yes, it's 212-787-6800, and we're located in New York City. And on the website, you could find a link, so if anyone has any questions, they could email me, and I would be happy to get back to them.
Well, Eric, that's a wrap. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with us, my friend.
My pleasure. Thank you for your time, Vip.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Your comments and your follow are so very welcome on my Twitter account at Vip Jaswal and my Facebook page, The Vip Jaswal Report. A special shout out of thanks to my wonderful team, William Sanchez and Rick Buser. Please do visit foxnewsradio.com for my complete library of shows that cover a variety of topics which impact our lives. You'll be spoiled for choice at what I've got to offer. Think of it as a candy shop for your ears. I'll be back next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern with more fascinating stories that fill our lives with the inspiration and information we so need to kickstart the week. I wish you a wonderful evening tonight with your family and loved ones, and until next Sunday, have a productive and a very happy week ahead.